in the golden age of Greece, Socrates was its first great philosopher. He had gained favor with the Athenians by fighting and saving his general's life in battle, and people thought him a great thinker. One of his students was Plato, who developed an academy to pass on the truths that he had learned from Socrates and codified the teaching into the divisions that we know of as philosophy. After years of teaching at the academy, he had a student named Aristotle. You've probably heard these names before, right? Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, who set up his own school outside the city of Athens, and he's the one who taught Alexander the Great, for instance. But the foundation on which their philosophy was built was simply this: courage. Courage is the first of human virtues because it makes all other virtues possible. That was the seed of what we think of as Western thinking, Western civilization. It's based on courage, because without courage, there is nothing else. It's sort of like the United States Constitution and amendments. Without the Second Amendment, everything else can be lost. You've got to have that ability to defend and to the courage to stand for it. Aristotle said that courage is a state or quality of mind that enables one to face danger or fear with confidence and resolution, to bring hope and courage, confidence to hearten others. Imagine sitting in a prison cell next to the Apostle Paul. We know that since creation, man has depended on one another. As John Donne said in his devotion, no man is an island, we're all part of the continent. But Paul needed courage and wanted to give his courage to Timothy, because Paul knew his time was coming to a close. Courage comes from unlikely places. In 1938, after the British gave up their right as allies to the Czechoslovakian people, and Neville Chamberlain returned to England saying that we have peace in our time, because he gave Hitler the right to just go into Czechoslovakia with knowing that no one would fight for the Czechs. A British subject was visiting Czechoslovakia, and he realized right away the hatred the Nazis that had come into rule had for the Jews. He worked as best he could behind the scenes to take young Jewish children and take them on holidays to England. He arranged the train and the sea transport across the channel for 669 children to leave Czechoslovakia and Hitler's rule and go to live with English families. It was never mentioned. It was not a Schindler's List. It was something that nobody knew until 2000, when the archives were looked back at as families tried to get together, and they realized that of the 669 children, all but 8 children's parents had been killed in the Holocaust. Queen Elizabeth called Nicholas Winton, this British subject, this businessman, and called him in and knighted him at 104 years of age, thanking him for the service. You see, looking fear or danger, or in the case of the Apostle Paul, looking at the executioner's sword directly in the eye without flinching is the sort of courage that we are to have. We celebrate holidays to celebrate the courage of others. We have Memorial Day coming up in a couple of weeks. the courage of those who have given their last full measure of devotion for our country. We have Veterans Day. We have the Independence Day to remember the forefathers and all the work they did. And I think in that list of courage holidays, I'm going to add Mother's Day. Is that okay if we can do that today? Because mothers sacrificed in labor, literally, for us. They were courageous and went through the valley of the shadow of death to bring us into the world. And so give us an example of the courage and faith that we all should have. Paul had been talking to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 1, where our text is, and he told them about the foundation of the gospel. I know whom I have believed. And then in verses 13 and 14, he said, Timothy, get a grip on this truth. Hold it tight in your hand. The next verse, guard this with every ounce of strength you have. And now, sadly, in verses 15 to 18, at the end of this chapter, Paul reminds Timothy that each one of us have the choice of cowardice and fear or courage and faith. He wants to motivate Timothy, just as he motivates us reading it, to not be like those who were fearful and those who were cowards for the work of God, but to stand, to get a grip, to guard, like Onesiphorus is used as a second example. So we'll look first of all at the example in verse 15 of cowardice and fear, because we have an example of evil works. He writes in 2 Timothy 1:15, you understand that all who are in Asia have turned away from me. Now, there was an exception to this, because Timothy was pastor of the largest church in Asia, in the church at Ephesus. But obviously, he was still faithful to Paul, but many Paul heard in prison had forsaken him. They'd abandoned him. When you're friends with people who are courageous, their work enhances our work. When we band together to do something, it's so much more joyful than just doing it by ourselves. Now, Asia in the New Testament didn't mean China and that part, the Far East. Asia meant what we would think of today as the western half of the country of Turkey. So if you think of Greece, you think of the whatever sea that is, the Aegean Sea there. I got to get that in the Adriatic between Italy and Greece. And over there to the side, that was all part of Greece. But the Romans called it the province of Asia. And so Timothy was there in this most important city. And Paul was saying that everyone has forsaken me. Deserting the apostle, not necessarily deserting Christ, but fear of being persecuted. I mean, let's face it, if the best known Christian is thrown in jail and under death sentence, how many people are going to say, well, I want to identify with him? No, we'll put our hand down because we don't want to end up in that same fate. Many of the Jewish believers were repudiating him because he preached to Gentiles. If you read the prison letters from his first imprisonment, you'll find the total of about three Jewish names in the whole list, from Colossians and Ephesians or Philippians and the other of the prison epistles that were there. The Asiatic desertion was very serious. Paul will write later in 2 Timothy that at my first trial, no one stood with me. People were leaving him. And so Paul is virtually alone. He is in a prison cell awaiting death any day, and it's very real to him. I was thinking, what sort of person would Paul be if he hadn't come face to face with fear? realizing I'm going to die. He'd written very inspired by the Spirit, for me to live as Christ and die as gain. But I don't know too many people who want to die. We're fearful. I don't know. What do you fear? Do you have fears that come in there? I mean, I'm not talking about spiders and snakes and sharks or lions and tigers and bears, oh my. But do you have fears that you have? Fear of public speaking? Yeah. Yeah, I see. No, this is written. Yeah, Jim, you're preaching next Sunday. Put your hand down. Job, you say, well, look at him. He had all this great confidence. Everything bad happened to him. But you know what Job said when he heard that his children had died? You read it. He said, what I feared most has come to pass. Someone asked me what I fear most. And I'll be honest with you, I fear Alzheimer's. I live in a brain that is working overtime all the time. And the fear that one day I'm not going to be able to think straight, or not going to be able to remember, or not be able to preach. I can't imagine that time. You're all imagining when I retire here and say, okay, we'll get other. I can't imagine what that's going to be like. At some time, we all come face to face with that panic, that fear, that realization, whether we're climbing a ladder or jumping into deep water, we all face it. We know what frightens us. And can you imagine losing your support network? All the believers that had been there with Paul are gone. And he lost everything. He'd by himself. I said, imagine you in the cell or in the chain next to him. Now the Bible says in Proverbs 29, the fear of a man brings a snare. That is something that entraps us. But the one who trusts the Lord will be lifted up. Paul is bravely putting on a front here, but the crack in the veneer is real, because, folks, the link between ministering and suffering is intrinsic. Everyone who pastors, everyone who has a ministry, our missionaries, our speakers, our evangelists, there's a reality there. A constant thing. And Paul says, everyone, all. No one was a super saint, including Paul, facing this emotional difficulty. Remember when Jesus said that he was going to die? John 6, it's a touching chapter in the Gospel of John. And Jesus says, I'm going to die. Unless you're willing to take up your cross and walk with me, you're going to die. We're in trouble. And John 6:66 says, many of his disciples stepped back and didn't walk with him anymore. Well, two of them are mentioned in this verse in the second half of it. He said, all who are in Asia have turned away from me, but Phugelus and Hermogenes, these guys are the examples that I'm going to use. Evidently, these were two notable men. Now, have you ever heard of them before? I had trouble just pronouncing their names. I looked at that and I said, oh, that's Phygellus, like an angel, Phygellus, and Hermogenes, probably a new type of trousers that somebody's developing for the generation. I didn't know anything about them. You know why I didn't know anything about them? Nobody knows anything about them. They're not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. Just Paul saying, everyone in Asia is left, and especially these two guys whose names are tough to pronounce. Some of us serve no other purpose than to be a bad example. And I have a feeling, some of us do a good job at that, by the way. I have a feeling that that's what these two men are there. The apostle doesn't dwell upon it. He just dismisses it in a single sentence that these two represented a special disappointment for Paul. There's no distinguishing things about them. Calvin wrote, Paul did this to put a stop to the slanderous attacks, for it usually happens that deserters from the Christian warfare seek to excuse their own disgraceful conduct by inventing whatever accusation they can have against the faithful and upright ministers. So Paul's in jail. We don't know what these men did or said, but they were the ringleaders. They were the ones that this 70-year-old apostle was facing. I know he refers to this to stimulate Timothy, to say, hey, you ought to have greater courage. Look at these guys who don't have any. They live with fear and cowardice, not courage. The greater the need, the greater the opportunity, the greater the darkness, the more important the light is to shine. But a lot of Christians are like flounders. Now, I don't know if you've ever caught a flounder or not. But a flounder is a really ugly bottom-feeding fish. It's bad. It changes color. It's kind of a dull gray if you pull it out of the water, but if it's in the water itself and it gets down in the mud where it's down there sucking through the bottom, it turns a brown to blend right in. If it goes into the area with algae and seaweed and that, it turns kind of a greenish yellow to blend right in. You know, that's where a lot of Christians are. I love the Lord, but I don't want anybody to know it. I'm a Christian, but I just want to blend in with the world. Whatever style, fashion, activity, music, language, I just want to be part one of the group. I just want to be a good old boy. These guys didn't even want to blend in with Christianity. They wanted to blend in with the world. They repudiated Paul. They repudiated his message. They didn't just run away. They said no. Now, who was Phygellus, or Phygellus, F-O-O-G-I-M-S? I printed out how to pronounce it correctly in the bulletin so I'd remember. And I thought, well, okay, what's his name mean? It's the Greek word fugitive. One who runs away. That's what his parents named the kid. Doesn't that help you? It's like a boy named Sue. You know, it's going to impact them for the rest of their life. The name that the parents gave me, he said, oh yeah, you're just one who runs away. We don't know what excuse he had to distance himself from Paul. Business, family, money, but real character was shown when he turned his back. When Paul needed friends, when he needed support, Phygellus was running away. Hermogenes, the emphasis on the N sound, E-N sound, Hermogenes, is from the Greek word born of Hermes. Now, who was Hermes? Can somebody help me? What?
God of mischief, thieves.
Yeah, the god of thieves and magicians, but I repeat myself. They're all making things disappear. He's the god who was the youngest of all the gods in the pantheon of Rome. And he was the trickster. He was the one who did things and then ran away. His symbol was a shoe with a wing on the back of it, or a helmet with wings on the side of it. Where have you seen that?
Tire company.
Yeah, tire company has a shoe. The mother. Come on, mothers. Yeah, the FTD, the florist things, right? Have the other, it's Mother's Day. Didn't you get flowers for your? What is that?
The Falcon's helmet.
Yeah, they run away a lot. Pardon?
Mercury had nine.
Yes. That's right. Yes. Yeah. Hermes is the Greek name, Mercury is the Latin name. Right. Same guy. It's the wing god. And who makes sickness disappear? The special group called doctors. And if you look at the AMA and the symbol for doctors, it's going to be a snake wrapped around a staff with wings at the top of Hermes, because it's all tied together. That's from Moses and the serpent and the woman. It's a fantastic analogy there. But, he broke all the rules. He was, so basically if you're born of Hermes, you're born running. So you got one guy named Running Away and the other guy named Running. And I thought, well, we don't know much about them, but we know their names. And Pastor King said they couldn't help their ugly names, but they could have helped their ugly character. I'm not sure how good that is, but, these were ones who are remembered in the scriptures as being traitors, of turning their back at the time of greatest need, of running away. The saddest thing about betrayal is that it never comes from your enemies. It can only come from a friend. Timothy and us were to be deterred from this cowardice. Bravery would be seen to contrast with this cowardly action. John MacArthur wrote, "To be rejected by the world is not pleasant, but to be deserted by fellow workers in the service of Christ is particularly painful. To have those you spent your life spiritually nurturing turn away from you, turn against you, is heartbreaking in the extreme." The Bible often introduces a man onto the stage and then dismisses them with a single word, a list of his names, one action. "Well, all these in Asia turned away from me, especially Phugalus and Hermogenes. What would be the word that people will use about you? What word would you like them to describe your life as? I don't think deserter, betrayer, coward, fearmonger. I don't want those words to be used of me. And so Paul says, okay, if we're going to take examples, you got to start out with the bad example. The example of no courage. But now, instead of cowardice and fear, he's going to spend the next three verses talking about someone who is just the opposite, Onesiphorus. He says in verse 16, under this example in his action of courage and faith, he said, "May the Lord show mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, for he frequently brought me relief and wasn't ashamed of my chain." Onesiphorus was obviously a different sort of man than Phugalus or Hermogenes, whatever. He was faithful to Paul, no matter what the circumstances might be. And Paul prays for mercy on his home, on his family. Mercy to show kindness for one who in spiritual need had found kindness from that dear man. Mercy gives attention to those in misery. Mercy, I read, includes three parts: to recognize the need, to be motivated to meet the need, and then actually meet the need of someone else. I see the need, I'm moved by it, and I act to meet that need. Mercy said, "I have feelings of sorrow for this." And Paul rightly did have feelings of sorrow for this family, the family of Onesiphorus. He lived near Timothy, Paul says later in the epistle, to greet his family. Who was he? His name is different than the running away or the running guys mentioned in the previous verse. His name means help bringer, the one who helps. a combination of two simple Greek words that we would simply say someone who's a loyal friend, someone who will be there. His name is only mentioned in this epistle, not in the book of Acts, not anywhere else in the Bible. But he demonstrated a different sort of character in his life. Thomas Watson, the Puritan divine, wrote, "Show your piety by your pity." Chuck Colson said, "Our presence in a place of need is more powerful than 1,000 sermons." And Vance Havner, the Christian humorist, said that if God dealt with people today the way he did in the days of Ananias and Sapphira, every church would need to build a morgue in the basement. We don't need the running away. We don't need the traitors. You say, well, I'm not going to make any big issue. I'm not going to make a stand. Let me tell you something to the young people here, the unmarried folks. I made a list of what I was looking for in a wife. On that list were a bunch of things that I thought were important because I was going to be a minister. I knew I was going to be a pastor. And I needed someone who would be a godly pastor's wife, a godly mother to my 13, we planned, children. Well, we had no kids and great ideas later when we had three kids. That was enough. But I had this whole list. I was thinking she had to be able to play the piano. She had to be able to sing. She had to be beautiful. She had to, I listed this whole bunch, and I wasn't going to settle for anything less. At our college, there was a special class done once a week in the evening that was by the president of the college's wife. And it was a class for girls only, college-age gals, who wanted to learn what it would be like to be a pastor's wife, because she had been one for 50 years. And how, you know, what you had to do to be the godly wife. And then she went through this list of what you have to look for in a godly man to be a husband. Okay, so I had a list, homemade, but as best I could do. My wife was in that class. How do I know? Because many of us were climbing up the fire escape and looking in the window to see who was in there looking to be a pastor's wife so we could narrow the field down of the gals in the college and we could choose the ones that we thought. Anyway, that's not in my notes. I got to get back here to the Greek or the Hebrew or whatever it is. But you need to do that. Set your standards high. Say, God, I want this kind of a person to be my mate for life. And Paul gives a special prayer for Onesiphorus' family. Regarding him, only the past tense is used. All the verses here, verses 16, 17, 18, and again at the end of the book, they're all past tense. He doesn't say give mercy to Onesiphorus. He said, God be merciful to his family. He had come and spent time with Paul, but evidently he's in the past tense now, that he's dead. And Paul is left without the one guy who could really help him. So Paul focuses his prayer on his family and says, hey, this guy, bless me. Father, show mercy to his house. And the word house there is literally a metonymy, which stands for his family, the ones who live in his house. And so the apostle said, you know, he was a great man. He refreshed me with his visits. He was an intentional blessing. You know, when we talk to someone on the phone or when we stop by a house, when we send them a note or an email, we can be an encouragement to them. We'll never know what a blessing we can be. When I first started in the ministry, I'd go to visit with somebody and I'd sit there and say, start talking about myself. Because you got to talk about something. You can't just sit there with folks. And so I'd tell them about this or that and my troubles and give advice on what I'd do if I were in their shoes. And pretty soon we weary and get tired of the whole thing, and they're pretty weary after about 2 minutes of listening to us. And we need to bring sunshine. We need to bring joy to others. People ought to know us as the happiest, the most gracious people in the world. We're not just bringing a smile, we're bringing a platter of lemon bars. We're doing whatever we can. We're enjoying it. It says here that he refreshed me. And that literally means to cool me off. And I'm thinking that's metaphorical, of course. But Paul says it's like the air conditioning in my cell was turned on when he came. He just lifted me up. He wasn't ashamed of my chain. Now, you got to remember, Paul is not under house arrest like in his first imprisonment. But here he's waiting in the wing for capital punishment in the death row prison. And he is chained. His ankles are chained together. His wrists are chained together with a brace on each wrist and chain. And then to add insult to injury, down in that dungeon with a number of other men who were in that same condition, each one had a Roman soldier chained to him. To the middle of those chains between his wrists was a Roman soldier sitting there who had plenty to eat, who had stuff to read or whatever they did there. And here was Paul sitting in the corner, chained together, and then a special long chain put on him, on his manacles, tying him to that Roman soldier. That's what he says. He said, this man wasn't just ashamed of my chains, plural, but of my chain, the chain that tied me to the Roman soldier that's going to someday just say, okay, it's time. Stand up, walk out. And because Paul was a Roman citizen, he would get either his head chopped off or run through with a sword rather than crucified, tortured, as non-citizens would be punished. He, Onesiphorus, despised the shame, but he didn't despise the chain that bound Paul to his death sentence. Some people are quick to jump at a chance to fame. Someone will mention a name, and I'll say, oh, I know who that is. Or, oh yeah, we're friends. Well, I know him at least. I went to a studio in the Hollywood Burbank area to be with on Jeopardy. Take a test, go there and take and look and see what it is. And they sat me in the front row and got a chance to talk to Alex Trebek. How many of you have ever talked to Alex Trebek? Yeah, you see, I just throw that out there just as a common illustration. Now, see, that's what we do. We throw out big names. Someday you're going to say, oh, yeah, do you know Bob Griffin? Yeah. And everyone here will go, no, that name sounds familiar, but don't recall the guy at all. Well, when they're famous, everybody jumps at a chance to say, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. I went to this concert, or I did this, or I read that person's book. But when they're not famous, when they're on death row, no clue who that is. A nobody? Now we're prone to cut them or drop them off like Peter did with Jesus at the high priest's house while Jesus was being interrogated. So, what did he do? He brought me relief. He wasn't ashamed of my chain. Verse 17 and the first part of verse 18 continue. When arriving in Rome, he earnestly searched for me and then found me. Then he says, may the Lord grant to him God's mercy in that day. talking about the day of judgment. Earnest, intense, difficult search. You know, there's lots of prisons in Rome. We had the opportunity to go there to the Maritime Mamertine prison in just to the south of the Colosseum, the place where Paul was on one of our visits there. But there were prisons all over the city. We don't know how difficult it was, but Onesiphorus stuck with it. You know, he had made a promise. This was his friend. He'd left Ephesus and come to Rome. We don't know why, but there he is. And he's not going to give up till he finds Paul. You know, sometimes we do token service. Someone will say, well, can you do this if it's possible? And we make a little effort and go, well, not possible, can't do it. We appease our own conscience. We feel like we've done the best we could. Onesiphorus, he said, no way. I'm not going to give up till I find Paul. I'm that kind of a friend. Diligent, eager, zealous. Following what is written in Hebrews 13, verse 3, remember the prisoners as though you're in prison with them. And those who are ill-treated, since you are also part of the body. Jesus said that he commended those who visited him when he was in prison, when he was naked, when he was hungry. And remember what they said, when did we see you like that? He said, when you did it to the least of your brothers, you did it to me. He was that kind of a friend. I don't know about you, but I'd like to be known as a friend of God. I'd like to be known as a friend of other Christians. One that would be willing to sacrifice and die. Give the kindness and the sympathy and the help. The book of Psalms, verse 18 of chapter 88 says, the lover and friend you put far from me. Mine acquaintances you put into darkness. Literally, you see the lovers, friends, acquaintances, that's the three levels of friendship that we can have. But Paul found in this fellow the real love and the care. And as he had prayed for his family in the previous verse, now he prays that in the day of judgment, at that day, the Lord's mercy will go to Onesiphorus. Now, many times the word day is used in Scripture to refer to the day of judgment, day of the Lord, the last day. We use that a lot. But it's basically the end time, the day of judgment, the day when God's going to lift us up. And Paul says, I pray that God will give him mercy. He's such a great guy, such a faithful worker. Where the others were such cowards and fearful, he was one that stood by me. We don't ever deserve, matter of fact, I don't think we can deserve mercy. Mercy is something given, it's not something we deserve. Mercy is, well, look at it, justice comes first. Justice is getting what we deserve. What do we deserve? The soul that sins dies, not just the body, the soul dies, hell. That's justice. Mercy is not getting what we deserve. We deserve hell, and God in mercy takes pity on us. And then God, by his grace, gives us something we don't deserve, and that's called heaven. That's called eternal life. So, got to keep those phrases in mind here, because grace is God's solution to our sin problem. It's got to take grace. But mercy is his solution to our misery, to the difficulties we face. God, be merciful to us. We're sick. We have challenges. We have economic needs. We have family issues. I think of those who are suffering this Mother's Day. mothers who are alone and forgotten, mothers whose kids won't come to the nursing home to see them. We think of children who grew up without mothers. We think of mothers who were abusive, or who, when the going got tough, just took off and ran away and abandoned their family. Mother's Day is not such a fun holiday for everyone. Someone said that Mother's Day has the most phone calls of any day of the year. The most phone calls. And the most collect phone calls is Father's Day. Don't ask me exactly how that works. Maybe they're calling from prison. I don't know. But I'm thankful that God's throne is mercy, not marble. That he's tender and recognizes our needs. And Paul prays and says, God, in that day of judgment, show mercy to this guy. Look at him. His works proved his faith. We can't demand it. Jesus told the story in Luke chapter 13 of a master of a house who had gone to bed, shut the door, and someone stood outside and knocked and said, Lord, open to us. And he looks out the window and says, I don't even know you. Why should I open the door? Mercy's not necessarily what humans do. But God is merciful, and Paul prays that in that last day, God give him mercy. And then he adds this little postscript in the last part of the last verse of our text, in verse 18. He says, also, you know better than I do all the service he rendered me at Ephesus. So evidently, Onesiphorus was exemplary, faithful, outstanding, so much so that Timothy would know him. He'd say, oh yeah, when I was in Ephesus and Paul was there for years, he said, this guy was there. You remember that, Timothy. And Paul uses this to support the charge of constancy that he wants believers to have. That we should be there. You know, you'll know better. People will know. No matter what the circumstances are. The poet Gustafson wrote, our world around us surges. Duties vie for all our time, our energies, our care. But greater duty urges, do not pass by a hurting heart whose burden we may share. He was known for one who did good works. Don't you want to be known that way? When your day comes, we don't know how long we have in this life, but I would like people to say, oh yeah, here's the clothes she made for us, like they did about Dorcas who died. Or remember them. What a blessing they were while we were with them. He ministered. He did such good works. The service there. The word service is the word diakonos. We get the word deacon from that. To minister. To do the busy work. Because the deacons in the church were to deek. That's the verb. They were to deek. They were to give food to the needy. And they were to help the preacher. And they were to just be the servants. I like that. I said, well, what does the word deacon actually mean? Get this. It means running through the dust. And I thought, what? And then, of course, the explanation is that this is what people do when they're cleaning house. They go through the dirt and the dust and they sweep it all up and they do the mundane stuff. Isn't that what you think sometimes when you're vacuuming the floor or mopping or dusting the... How many of you dust? I'm not familiar with that term myself, but, you know, my wife always said that she doesn't mind if you write in the dust in our furniture, just don't write the date. I love you, dear. It's Mother's Day. Yeah, That's what this guy did. He served. He was a he ran through the dust, sweeping things up. Whatever Paul needed, he did. And he says, Timothy, you remember he did this back in Ephesus. He didn't just wait till I got in chain in Rome. He's been that kind of a guy. And that's what God wants us to be. Faithful, courageous. Say, no matter what, I'll do whatever needs to be done. And when that last day comes, we might not be called before the queen to be knighted at 104. We might be more like Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Germany, a Lutheran pastor who preached the truth. He preached the gospel. He preached salvation through Christ. He preached to love one another. And the Nazis, who had already arrested and imprisoned and for the most part killed all the mentally challenged, all the gypsies, and now we're rounding up 6 million Jews. See, nobody fought against that. And so the next group they went to were the preachers. And they arrested Bonhoeffer and put him in prison. And he sat there on death row for months. And as the Allied forces were closing in the last week of the war, as they were liberating the terrible death camps and prisons all over Eastern Europe and Germany, instead of freeing the prisoners, the pastors that were held in Hitler's prison, the guards decided it was time to execute them. Bonhoeffer that day led the prisoners in worship. He preached from Isaiah 53 on the perfect work of Christ and that his atonement was all that we need. And in front of his fellow prisoners, he was led into the courtyard and up the scaffold, the noose put around his neck. And his last words were, "This is the end, but for me, it's the beginning of real life." Courage and faith, cowardice and fear. God gives us the chance today of how we're going to be remembered. With tears in our eyes, we remember Bonhoeffer and his courage. Chances are we won't face the scaffold, but we don't know. That could come because some of our brothers and sisters in Christ are facing Islam's sword while we're speaking here and sitting in the relative comfort of our meeting room. How will you be remembered? Our life is fleeting. The memory will be gone. Jack told me of one of his relatives who had a stroke and then needed help to get around, and he watched her mind slowly going. She couldn't remember things of the past. She couldn't remember 10 minutes ago. Jack wondered when his wife said that they should take her out for dinner on Mother's Day. He wondered if it was necessary, since within a couple of hours she would forget what they had done. And his wife Jenny responded, saying, "At least while we are with her, she'll know that we love her." And for those few minutes, it will be worth it. Do what's right. Be remembered like Onesiphorus, even if you can't spell or pronounce his name correctly. You can vow to be that kind of a courageous witness for Christ.